We have less than a minute, but you recently wrote a piece about the U.S. political institutions, FBI, CIA, State Department, so often targets of progressives concerned about these institutions now being targeted by Republicans. Can you talk about this shift in the last 45 seconds?
One of my professors in college was Howard Zinn. He was always telling us that the Justice Department and the FBI and the CIA were engaged in conspiracies against American freedom. Now I'm hearing this from right-wing Republicans. It's an amazing role reversal. Now, those Republicans who always wanted to defend the institutional strength of the United States want to rip down the institutions that undergird American democracy. So we're now seeing the wrecking crew from the group of political operatives who used to believe that upholding institutions was the ultimate goal of the United States. Devin Nunes is sounding more like Angela Davis every day. It's really a remarkable change to see this coming out of a Republican White House and a Republican Congress.
What a way to end the show. Stephen Kinzer, I want to thank you for being with us. But we are going to do part two of our conversation. We're going to post it online at democracynow.org, as we didn't talk about some of the countries the U.S. overthrew their democratically elected leaders, from Chile to Guatemala to Iraq to back to the 19th century. That does it for our show. Stephen Kinzer, author of The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and The Birth of the American Empire, as well as the book Overthrow. I'm Amy Goodman. And with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, THAKYOU.
KABU makes a positive difference in all our lives. Thank you for supporting this effort to keep Portland vital and engaged. Thank you for keeping Portland radical, and thank you for supporting KABU.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for keeping KABU fierce, vital, and independent, accountable to no one but you, the community.
Thank you.
Thanks for supporting KABU.
Thank you. Thank you so much for donating to KABU's Kickstarter to help make a city of media makers.
Thank you.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sister Spirits Pagan Fair 2018. On Saturday, March 24th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Oaks Park Dance Pavilion in Portland. Sister Spirits Pagan Fair features pagan artists, ritual, storytelling, raffles, and more. There will be performances by Tracy Graham, Fairwind Blowin', and more. Again, that's Sister Spirits Pagan Fair 2018. On Saturday, March 24th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Oaks Park Dance Pavilion, 7805 Southeast Oaks Park Way in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, we take a look at the fire on Northeast 75th Avenue and Killingsworth Street.
There have been several bombings in Austin, Texas that all seem to be related.
And we take a look at the impending international face-off over the poisoning of a Russian spy and his daughter in the United Kingdom.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, March 12th, 2018. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Mahdi. In honor of Sunshine Week, the transparency and openness of the Oregon government gets graded. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and the KABU Evening News, reporter Grace Ann Smith has more.
It's Sunshine Week, which highlights the public's ability to access information about the government and also some of the challenges the public still faces to more transparency. Lawyer Dwayne Bosworth is a public records expert at Davis Wright Tremaine, who has defended journalists and fought for access to officials' records in public meetings. He says openness is a hallmark of our democracy. While Oregon prides itself on not being corrupt and having a lot of public participation in government, Bosworth says the state could do much better.
I would say it gets an F in transparency, and largely that public records, but there are many, many mistakes made with regard to public meetings and making sure the public can attend and participate.
Bosworth touts the virtues of having openness in government and some of its successes, including investigations into problems with the jail and school system, wrongdoing by public officials, and analysis of programs that aren't serving the public adequately. Bosworth believes the barriers to open records are growing, although they have shifted. While there are still fights over which documents can be withheld, cost is becoming the biggest burden.
The costs that are imposed on individuals or the media in order to obtain records, and those instances very often make obtaining the records prohibitive, certainly for individuals, but also for legacy media and others.
Bosworth says Oregon's statute also allows a significant delay in providing records and that the law for waiving or reducing fees on records is poor. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and the KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
A man was killed by Hillsborough police on Saturday. Few details have been released since the shooting. The officers have not yet been named but have been placed on paid administrative leave pending an investigation by the multi-agency Washington County Major Crimes Team. Police say they responded to a domestic disturbance call late Saturday night in the 2000 block of Southeast 54th Avenue in Hillsborough. As they approached the home, according to a press release from the Hillsborough Police, they encountered a man with a firearm. KPTV reported the man's weapon was a shotgun. The press release said there was an exchange of gunfire in which the civilian was killed. The two officers were unhurt.
This morning, a large fire started at an auto salvage yard in the Cully neighborhood of Northeast Portland. The yard is located near Gardner's Meat Market on Northeast Killingsworth and 75th Avenue. By early afternoon, it had spread to nearby properties, burning at least three structures, including an apartment building. At 11:30 a.m., according to KGW, the fire bureau began evacuating people from homes on 75th Avenue. Sacagawea Head Start students were evacuated to shelter at Scott's School on Prescott until they could be picked up. People within a one-mile radius were told to close all doors and windows and turn off all HVAC systems. A plume of black, acrid smoke traveled as far as Forest Grove. The Oregon Public Health Division tweeted out a reminder this afternoon that smoke from burning tires can contain many toxic chemicals, including cyanide, carbon monoxide, and sulfur dioxide. Despite the thickness and widespread of the smoke, no flights have been canceled at PDX as of 2 p.m. Power has been shut off in the area. According to KGW, wind and downed power lines have been hampering the efforts of firefighters, and the Bureau expects to have crews on scene overnight.
The second leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. is colorectal cancer, but a third of people who should be screened haven't been. A home screening called the FIT test is an increasingly popular alternative to colonoscopies. To learn more, KBOO reporter Miranda Krause filed this story in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and health professionals are stressing that people should get screened. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States. Doctors suggest people 50 and older should get screened, but nearly a third of Americans who should get screened aren't up to date. There are two options. One is a colonoscopy every 10 years. The other is known as a FIT test, taken at home once a year. Specialists analyze tests for blood in the stool, a possible sign of the cancer. Jen Corey with Care Oregon says a lot of people prefer the FIT test.
The great thing about colorectal cancer screening is that it actually saves lives. So survival is 93% if you catch colon cancer in stage 1, and it's 8% if you catch it in stage 4.
People with a family history of colorectal cancer should talk to their doctors because they are at a higher risk of the disease. African Americans, Native Americans, and Alaska Natives are also at higher risk and should begin screenings at age 45. Corey says Care Oregon provides help to clinics in order to increase their screening rates.
One of the things we're doing is mailing FIT tests to people who are overdue for screening. Then they do the test at home and they send it back to their own doctor. So we've gotten such a great response just from mailing people FIT tests. 30% of the people we mailed FIT tests to completed the screening and returned it to their doctor.
Doctors say people can lower their risk of colorectal cancer by getting active, eating healthy, not smoking, and losing weight. Taking a daily low-dose aspirin has been shown to reduce the formation of polyps, an indicator of this cancer. But folks should consult their doctor about this approach. On KBOO Evening News, this is Miranda Krause in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
The Greener Fuels Act could potentially reverse damage to grasslands from conversion to biofuel sources. For more on this, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, here's KBOO reporter Grace Ann Smith.
A bill to reform the biofuels mandate could reverse a decade of destruction to America's grasslands, according to environmental groups. The Greener Fuels Act would gradually reduce the amount of biofuels such as corn ethanol in the nation's fuel supply. It would also stop more land from being converted into biofuel sources and invest more than $10 billion to restore lost fish and wildlife habitat in the next 10 years. More than 7 million acres have been plowed to make way for corn and soy since the fuel standard went into effect in 2007, including in Oregon. Bob Reese, a fishing guide in the state, says there's another reason why fishers support the Greener Fuels Act.
The additional expenses that's come about through the ethanol mandate with the havoc that ethanol places on our outboard motors, not just a safety factor, but the fact that we're expending more money than we historically have in motor repairs and breakdown costs, loss of fishing days because our boats are in the repair shop.
Reese adds, corn and soy croplands are water intensive, putting another strain on natural resources. But supporters of the renewable fuel standards say ethanol also has some environmental benefits that this bill would undermine. Colin O'Mara, president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, thinks the legislation could correct a mistake Congress made 10 years ago.
It minimizes the impacts on the landscape and actually invests in the restoration of America's grasslands and other habitat that's been impacted, while at the same time moving us towards cleaner, more sustainable fuels, which reduce emissions and help fight climate change.
He says the bill would eliminate a loophole that allows older biofuel plants to bypass climate pollution standards. It also would incentivize truly renewable biofuels, such as those derived from the farm waste and plant cellulose. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and the KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
The city of Austin, Texas, was on edge Monday after a series of package bombings left two city residents dead and two others badly wounded. The latest victim was a 75-year-old woman who was in critical but stable condition with serious injuries after the package she found outside her home exploded in her arms. That woman was injured just hours after a 17-year-old boy was killed and another woman injured by a second deadly delivery. The two cases bear similarities to the explosion that killed Stephen House, age 39, who was killed on March 2nd by a package bombing that was delivered to his Austin home. So far, police have not determined a motive, according to Austin's police chief, but they're not ruling out the possibility these could be hate crimes. The most recent victim was Hispanic. The other three victims were Black. The bombings are taking place as Austin hosts the South by Southwest Music, Film, and Technology Festival, which is attracting thousands of visitors. The festival beefed up its security 4 years ago after a driver plowed through a barricade and ran down festival goers, killing four people.
Jeff Sessions is currently trying to change the outcome of many asylum seekers. He recently overturned a 2014 ruling that all asylum seekers are entitled to a full hearing. He is claiming that the huge backlog of asylum cases is clogged by those seeking asylum for fraudulent reasons and is advocating for judges to be able to dismiss a case without fully hearing it. The decision allows judges to dismiss a case if it does not pass prima facie, the first impression of the case, without a full hearing. His interim decision 3918 states that, quote, The Attorney General referred the decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals to himself for review of issues relating to whether being a victim of private criminal activity constitutes a cognizable social group for purposes of an application for asylum and withholding of removal, ordering that the case be stayed during the pendency of his review, end quote. As told to the Washington Post, Secretary of the American Immigration Laws Association's Jeremy McKinney said, quote, "You don't make the system more efficient by taking away people's due process rights. All that's going to do is create more litigation," end quote.
Donald Trump seems to be walking back on his promise to raise the minimum age for buying guns from 18 to 21 years of age. This comes after he chided fellow Republican Patrick J. Toomey of Pennsylvania for being afraid of the NRA and claiming the NRA has, quote, "great power over you people. They have less power over me." Instead of failing to raise the age limits, he's pushing for more guns in schools by funding programs to give gun training to teachers, encouraging military veterans and retired officers to become teachers, and improving background checks. Senator Chuck Schumer tweeted on Sunday, quote, "The White House has taken tiny baby steps designed not to upset the NRA when the gun violence epidemic demands giant steps be taken. Senate Dems will push to go further, passing universal background checks." Currently, the NRA is suing the state of Florida after it passed a law raising the minimum age to buy firearms from 18 to 21. This comes less than a month after 17 students and staff were killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High in Parkland, Florida.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes as sovereign governments have the authority to collect taxes on their reservations. Eight tribes within South Dakota's boundaries, along with the National Congress of American Indians, are taking steps to make sure that authority remains in place. In April, South Dakota goes before the U.S. Supreme Court to argue that out-of-state and online vendors should collect and remit taxes from South Dakota customers. Tribes have filed a friend of the court brief to make sure the opinion does not disturb their current taxing authority. Victoria Wicks reports.
Derek Bizzo is an attorney representing the National Congress of American Indians. He says the tribes did not file their amicus brief to support one side or the other. Tribes want to make sure the opinion does not inadvertently allow the state to tax reservation residents or take away tribes' authority to impose sales taxes on their own members.
We know that the Supreme Court, when they're looking at an issue, sometimes they look at that issue very narrowly. We want to make sure that there's not unintended consequences that affect tribes' inherent regulatory authority to tax.
He says current tax law has been hammered out over generations of congressional action and Supreme Court decisions. And he says as the online marketplace grows, Congress continues to consider legislation to accommodate states' needs while protecting tribes' interests.
The Marketplace Fairness Act is a bill that's been pending before Congress for several different sessions, and we've had support within that bill, which specifically recognizes tribal taxing jurisdiction in the current version.
Bizzo says online shopping is important to reservation residents who might otherwise have to drive long distances to find products in stores. And he says tribal governments need tax revenues to offer services to their constituents. His contentions are echoed in the amicus brief, which notes that self-determinism and economic self-sufficiency in Indian country rely on income from tribal taxes and immunity from state and local taxes. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Last month, the House of Representatives passed a bill to give tribal authorities access to the Amber Alert system for locating missing children. Though the legislation has wide bipartisan support, lawmakers are having a tough time getting it onto the floor for a vote. Matt Laszlo has more from Washington.
In May of 2016, Ashlyn Mike was waiting for the bus with her brother when she was abducted. She never made it home. By the time authorities found her in a remote part of the Navajo Nation, she had been brutalized and left to die in the desert. It took authorities 10 hours to issue an Amber Alert for Ashlyn because tribal law enforcement doesn't have access to the system. Congress is working to change that. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin helped usher the bill through the House.
It was totally bipartisan on the House side, and it goes right to the question of public safety on the reservations.
Now the bill's moved to the Senate. The ranking member of the Indian Affairs Committee, Senator Tom Udall, thinks the bill is paramount to the safety of Indian country, but he says tribal leaders need to prioritize infrastructure upgrades for it to be fully effective.
There are, I think, very specific things they need to do to get it set up, to put the infrastructure in place, and they may need some help from us because these are areas that don't have very good broadband and don't have very good internet. So we need to find a way to make sure that any amber alert, an actual alert, gets out as widely as possible. That's the key to the system working.
The bill does allocate some funding to help connect reservations to amber alerts, but Udall says that's not enough.
We need a lot more resources behind this.
The White House released its top priorities for infrastructure last month, but nowhere did it mention any plans specifically for Indian country. And no vote has been scheduled on the amber alert bill in the Senate yet. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Philip Kenny about his new book, The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. At 6, it's Labor Radio, that's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, we'll have some showers with a low of around 50 degrees, followed by more showers and a high of around 50 degrees. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it will be partly cloudy with a low of 52 degrees, followed by showers on Tuesday. Today in history, in 1994, the Church of England ordained their first female priests, and in 2010, the number of women priests outnumbered male priests for the first time in history. The quote of the day is from Clara Fraser, a feminist and socialist born in 1923. She said, "All the many brands of suppression, racism, sexism, heterosexism, ageism, classism, are historical. They have not always been with us, it was not ever thus, and it's not going to be this way come the revolution."
And now it's time for today's Labor History in 2 minutes with your host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2 minutes. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day OSHA released its memorandum titled Employer Safety Incentive and Disincentive Practices. It addressed compliance officers and whistleblower investigators. It touched on employer practices that discourage the reporting of injuries and illnesses on the job. The memorandum stated that employee reporting is a protected right. It also asserted that employer discouragement could constitute a violation of whistleblower statutes like 11C of the OSHA Act and record-keeping regulations. OSHA emphasized that the likelihood of discouragement and discrimination increases when safety programs are linked to lower reported injuries and illnesses. The memorandum outlines 4 common scenarios. 1, when an employer disciplines workers injured on the job, employees must have a way to report injuries and illnesses. 2, when an employer disciplines workers for the time or manner in which they report an injury. 3, when a worker is disciplined for an injury as a result of violating a safety rule. OSHA asks, does the employer monitor the workplace regularly for safety compliance? Does the employer mete out discipline equally, regardless of injury? And finally, the memorandum stresses the need to examine the kind of safety program implemented. Does the program provide incentives to dissuade workers from reporting injuries and illnesses? Are prizes and bonuses awarded when reported injuries decrease? Discouraging and disciplining workers for reporting could be considered unlawfully discriminatory. It also violates the employer's obligation to document injuries and illnesses. OSHA notes there are positive ways to implement safety practices. Examples include rewarding workers who identify hazards, participate in investigations, and offer suggestions on how to make the job safer or complete safety training.
Public News Service is a member-supported news organization covering stories you probably won't hear about in mainstream media. Here's today's roundup.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, March the 12th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. The White House takes the wraps off its plans on guns. Also on our nationwide rundown, a report says a trade war over tariffs could cost farmers in states like Arkansas millions.
and this is Sunshine Week, which highlights the freedom of information. Now, our top story, the White House pledging to help states pay for firearms training for teachers, and the Associated Press reports it is repeating its call to improve the background check system as part of a new plan to prevent school shootings. The AP notes, in a move sure to please the powerful gun lobby, the plan does not include a push to increase the minimum age for purchasing assault weapons to the age of 21. Instead, a new federal commission on school safety will examine the age issue. Meantime, even though the National Rifle Association sued the state of Florida just after Governor Rick Scott signed a new gun control bill Friday afternoon, Tremell Gomes has been talking with parents of the victims at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, who are calling on other states to follow Florida's lead.
The bill changes the age required to buy a rifle from 18 to 21, bans bump stock sales, and creates a 3-day waiting period for all gun purchases, while also allowing armed school staff on Florida campuses. The NRA is now asking a federal judge to block the age restriction and keep the bill from being enforced. However, Tony Montalto, father of Parkland shooting victim Gina Montalto, is calling on other states to emulate Florida's new bill and create tighter restrictions.
We have paid a terrible price for this progress. We call on more states to follow Florida's lead and create meaningful legislation to make all schools safer. This time must be different.
The NRA says 18-year-olds are considered adults in most aspects and thus should be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights. The organization also says the bill works against the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause by not allowing 18 to 21-year-olds who follow the laws to buy a rifle.
Governor Scott, an NRA member, says there are members of the organization that agree and disagree with the passage of the bill and adds it isn't perfect in his eyes either. If President Donald Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports start a trade war, Mark Richardson tells us that Arkansas could take an almost $400 million hit to its economy.
Agricultural economists at the University of Arkansas say if the state's major trading partners retaliate with similar import taxes on commodities such as soybeans, rice, corn, and grain sorghum, the value of those products could drop precipitously. Eric Wales, a professor of agribusiness at the University of Arkansas, says the state is vulnerable because it is a major player in the global markets.
More than half of our production gets exported. China is one of our major markets, particularly for soybeans and for sorghum. And basically, there's just concern that the potential for retaliation, certainly by countries like China, is possible.
Wales estimates a trade war could cause Arkansas agriculture to lose almost 4,500 jobs.
Winter Storm Skylar will bring heavy snow and gusty winds to the northeast early this week, marking the third coastal storm to affect the region in the span of fewer than 2 weeks. That from the Weather Channel. They forecast a more impactful winter storm looking likely along the coast of New England on Monday into Tuesday, with blizzard conditions, possible heavy snow, and potentially damaging winds. A 34-year-old Asheville man is believed to be another casualty in a growing trend among firefighters. Stephanie Carson has more on the dangerous trend and what's keeping many communities from doing anything about it.
Will Willis died in late February of a rare kidney cancer, and doctors believe it's likely his years of fighting fires caused the illness. Cancer now is the leading cause of death among firefighters, according to the International Association of Firefighters. And it's not just the smoke that's causing damage. Experts believe the increased use of synthetic materials in building construction is a huge factor. Willis's cousin, Josh Jenkins, also a firefighter, says there are ways to reduce exposure, but it comes down to one thing.
All of those things basically boil down to money. You need funding for extra gear, and you need funding for an extractor, which is what washes turnout gear. They need funding for more staff.
New safety codes from the National Fire Protection Association call for fire departments to decontaminate gear after every fire by washing the uniforms. They also call for each firefighter to have two sets of turnout gear, but each set costs $3,000.
And finally, Mary Sherman reports that during a time when the media frequently comes under attack, supporters of freedom of the press say defending the First Amendment and promoting open government are more important than ever.
This is Sunshine Week, an annual initiative celebrating the crucial need for access of information to ensure government transparency and accountability. Danielle McLean with the Society of Professional Journalists says reporters are defenders of democracy, But in the current political climate, their role is often diminished.
Free press is essential in terms of telling the truth and allowing people to know exactly what's happening. I mean, it's essential that everybody has a voice and everybody was represented. That's the job of the news. We're here to help democracy.
McLean says the Freedom of Information Act is a crucial tool for journalists.
The Society of Professional Journalists and the Government Accountability Project are launching the Whistleblower Project to shed light on the work of whistleblowers and ensure they and the journalists they work with are protected and supported. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Oskar Gröning, the man known as the bookkeeper of Auschwitz, died today at the age of 96. He was one of the last group of people to be formally charged with war crimes from the Nazi occupation of Germany in World War II, which ended in the death of 15 to 20 million people within the camps. As bookkeeper, Gröning participated in keeping track of the wealth stolen from the Jewish people being sent to concentration camps, and the profits from the slave labor used within the camps. He had asked for mercy from the courts, because at his age he said that imprisonment would go against his right to life. The courts, however, overturned that request, stating he would be healthy enough to serve his sentence if given adequate nursing care. His care was important in that it was one of the first where a former SS agent was sentenced for being complicit in murder, even though he was not directly connected to any specific killings. In the end, he never served his sentence. He was sentenced in 2015 as an accessory to murder for over 300,000 deaths that occurred in Auschwitz. He stated that, quote, "No one should have taken part in Auschwitz. I know that. I sincerely regret not having lived up to this realization earlier and more consistently." End quote.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May said today that British investigators have concluded it was highly likely Russia was responsible for the poison attack that left a former Russian double agent and his daughter comatose on a park bench last week. The British leader said police identified the poison as a military-grade nerve agent developed by Russia in 1987 and known as Novichok. In her remarks, May called the attack reckless since it had a danger to the lives of its two principal victims, Sergei Skripal, 66, and his daughter Yulia, 33, and it exposed many others, including a police officer who remains hospitalized. Skripal was jailed in Russia in 2006 for selling state secrets to British intelligence, but was released in 2010 as part of a spy swap. He and his daughter remain in critical condition at a Salisbury hospital. The Russian government denounced May's speech as part of an anti-Russian media campaign.
The international women's strike was last Thursday. KBOO reporter Jasmine Moneymaker was there and filed this report.
International Women's Day was on Thursday. Hundreds of Portlanders participated in a strike, rally, and march in Pioneer Courthouse Square. The strike was organized and led by women of color who are active in a variety of social justice movements in Portland. KBOO was at the rally, and what follows are excerpts of speeches of all of the women who spoke, except for two. Maria Garcia and Teresa Rayford both gave powerful speeches, but they are running for office, and so we cannot air them here. We will be posting the recording of all the speeches, uncut, on the website in the coming week. You can find their words there. This is strike organizer and rally MC Alyssa Pariah.
Women in over 50 countries in the world are coming together for International Women's Day, and you are part of it. When the International Women's Strike talks about feminism for the 99%, what they're talking about is women who tend to get forgotten. Because in typical sort of the historical legacy that we sit in, we uphold women to go high up and to be CEOs and people who run shit around the world. And we say that is incomplete. That rather than focusing on the ceiling so that a few of us can get to the highest heights, we want to raise the floor. Yeah! some of the women who we know, besides women of color, poor people, and women in developing countries around the world that get forgotten in this feminist discourse, we know that also trans women. I'm a trans woman. I understand that there are a lot of women that will say you're no woman at all and you should not be here involved in anything related to feminism. And I'm telling you all that I don't care because I'm going to keep struggling. It doesn't matter.
This is Lamara Hayes, an organizer with the Community Alliance of Tenants.
As you move forward, make sure that white cis feminism isn't your threshold. We're not striving to simply become CEOs and take the place of the gateholders that happen to be cishet white men. We're striving to be past that. We're striving for every single woman in this world to have her choices, right? That's what it's about. And so, as we move forward, again, no pussy hats, right? Not everybody has a pink pussy, right? Right? Yeah, you can cheer because it's true, you know? Wild how that is. And also, not every woman has a
vagina.
Right, you got it. Awesome.
This is Koya Crispin.
My grandmother used to say to us kids, if you always take it on the chin, nothing will ever change. The status quo is dead, been dead. Our upcoming generation of daughters depend on us to ensure that this happens. Transforming social norms and traditional practices that harm or discriminate against our young girls is a key part of our work as organizers in our community. If our daughters are protected, cared for, and participate in this movement, they are more able to benefit from a system that they themselves have helped shape. A system of better health, education, and economic development. To be just, it is not enough to simply be aware of the injustice and analyze the root causes. Our daughters' creativity and concrete actions can move this adult world to become more responsive to injustices in powerful and transformative ways.
Olivia Pace from Socialist Alternative.
If there's one thing that I would want you to take away from today is even though our capacity right now as workers is lower than we would like it, go back to your workplaces and think critically about how much you're being paid, how you're being treated, if what you're getting is good enough, even if you have a job that you consider good. Our standards for how we should be treated under capitalism, for how much we should be compensated for our work, for the value of our labor, is so low. We are taught that just having a job, having some kind of penance from the 1% is enough. It is not enough.
Lila.
Sex workers don't have to be students or single mothers to be justified in the way they earn their living. Sex workers are people, and if your feminism gets hung up on the construct of choice or empowerment in the matter, you're missing the f***ing point.
Yeah.
In our society, some labor is valued and some labor is not. Some voices are invited into the public sphere, while others are silenced. We need to ask ourselves, whose narratives are we comfortable with? Whose stories are getting erased? Whose issues ultimately matter? Whose problems are worthy of solutions? I'm talking about visibility, knowledge, and privilege, and there are real-life stakes to our refusal to ask ourselves these questions. Sex workers of color, particularly those who are queer and trans-identified, are losing their lives because of our refusal to ask ourselves these questions.
When Lila was getting her master's degree, she realized that she had been a victim of sex trafficking, but hadn't had the language to describe her experience.
What do we do when people use the wrong words to discuss sensitive issues? Do we meet them with patience and empathy? Are they invited in? Or do we cut them out of the discussion completely? When we choose control and righteousness, how are we complicit in the silencing of marginalized and vulnerable people?
Ray is a stay-at-home mom and an activist with Family Forward.
In theory, the invisible hand of the market is supposed to make for a fair society, but that's bull. Capitalism is dependent on an entirely different invisible force. It's a force that's kept purposely invisible so that powerful people can tell themselves that they are self-made. Powerful men are especially enamored with this myth. They would have us believe that they pulled themselves out of the womb by their own bootstraps.
The invisible force she describes is caregiving. Work that is vital to society but underappreciated and undercompensated.
A small start to that compensation would be passing the Family Act. This bill would provide 12 to 18 weeks of paid family medical leave. That's to care for a new baby, a sick family member, be with someone at the end of their life, and it covers both biological and chosen family members. This bill sets up an insurance fund paid by employers and employees equally at 0.5%. It's not the most progressive bill, but it is a step in the right direction towards recognizing caregiving. As long as we keep pressure on our legislators in Oregon, we do believe it will pass in the next session. If this is important to you, please find out how you can help this bill pass by visiting timefororegon.org or familyforwardaction.org. Thank you.
This is Abby from the Democratic Socialists of America.
Women and people of color have historically been at the forefront of social change in our country. From black women ensuring the success of the Black Belt Communist organizing in Alabama in the 30s, to black women organizing to keep a pedophile out of office just last year in Alabama. Women of color are the backbone, the core, and the heart of this movement.
Yeah.
And I'm standing in front of you now because I believe in a socialist future. A future without exploitation and oppression in all its forms. A future for people, not for profits. It is that idea that leads women, the people of color, the workers, the youth, the undocumented, the 99% to continue to fight. We want healthcare and free college for all. We want the Clean Dream Act passed now and amnesty for all. We want to live in a world without borders because no human is illegal on stolen lands.
Yes!
Our worth is not defined by our capacity to produce an output. We are fighting for a system that values us as humans and not dollar signs because the future is dictated by the present and we are done fighting for crumbs. We won't stop until we get the slice of cake. Woo!
Yasmin Ayu of International Socialist Organization and Occupation Free Portland.
Hello, Portland. Thank you for coming out today to participate in this socialist tradition. My name is Yasmin Ayu, but I'm a Palestinian woman and I'm in the International Socialist Org and Occupation Free Portland. Today and on this day since 1909, we have strikes to illuminate the flaws in this system. We have strikes to demand change for the improvement of our own lives as we struggle under capitalism. We strike as not only women, but as proletariat. But not every woman can be with us today in this strike. There are women who, across the globe, can't leave work for fear of being fired, assaulted, for fear of things that many women in this country wouldn't think of. Today in Palestine, women are functioning under the same occupation-stricken world as they have since 1947. Palestinian women everywhere in this world feel this, and we carry it for the generations to come and the ones that have gone. We fight and we strike not just for equal pay, or equal rights, or equal opportunity. We strike to illuminate the fights that our lives are consumed by under this system, and furthermore, under the occupation of Palestine that has come with that. Today, across the globe, we strike against the system that fuels the apartheid state of Israel. We strike against lifetimes, generations, centuries of struggling under capitalism. Today, whether you knew it or not, you are striking for Ahed Tamimi. You can do this every day if you so choose to join myself and others in the BDS movement and further the socialist proletarian movement. Joining us in boycotting the apartheid state of Israel. The system is murderous. It thrives on oppression. It is ruthless. It is time for us to wake and rise. Another world is necessary for us, for women, and everyone else, everywhere else, for Palestine. Thank you in solidarity.
Laura Galindo read a love letter to her employers.
Dear employers, do you know what it's like being brown in Portland? It means that because of the color of my skin and my gender, you pay me less than anyone else in the office. Yeah. It means that you hired me for being bilingual, but you refuse to pay my worth. It is so frustrating to constantly be tokenized by you and the rest of the staff whenever they don't know how to say something in Spanish. If you want to use my translation skills, pay me for it. It means that while you have the privilege to bike to work and get your exercise of the day, I am on my way to work for you on the bus, scared to sit next to a white person. Scared to sit next to a white person because I'm traumatized. I am afraid to get stabbed to death by Nazis. Sometimes I catch myself wondering if I should even attempt to look more white, sound more white, so that I can make it to work alive.
No.
Of course I don't, but you know, I wonder.
And last but not least,
that was Jasmine Moneymaker reporting from the women's strike last Thursday.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Miranda Krause, Sam Bowman, Grace Ann Smith, Tom Flynn, Ken Jones, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Motti. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener commentary. At 9, on Alternative Radio, author and activist Joe Allen revisits one of the major atrocities of the 20th century, the war on Vietnam. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, onstage in studio D-May welcomes performers from a world premiere dance piece entitled Hedda Gabler at the Northwest Dance Project. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Jess Perlitz and Joel W. Fisher about their shows at Hoffman Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
If you're a writer or an artist or composer, or really anyone doing something creative, you might have been filled at one time with self-doubt. It's very common for even the most successful artists to feel they're just not good enough, and this can hamper their creativity, sometimes to the point of paralysis. Our in-depth guest today, Philip Kenny, has written a new book on how to navigate your way out of this mindset. It's called The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. Philip is a Portland-based writer and psychotherapist who over the past 30 years of practice has treated a number of people going through the emotions and stresses of the creative life, and he's personally experienced it in his own work as an author. We're fortunate to have Philip live with us now in the KBOO studios to talk about his book and how to overcome that self-doubt. Philip Kenny, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Ken. I'm glad to be here.
Philip, I mentioned in the intro you're both a therapist and a writer, in fact, a published author of two novels, collection of poetry. Did your new book, The Writer's Crucible, get its inspiration from your experiences as a psychotherapist or writer or both?
Really from both. I've been writing for almost as long as I've been practicing psychotherapy. And, you know, I work with so many writers and artists who struggle with the problems and the insecurities that come with the terrain and the self-doubt.
Can you describe some of the types of self-doubt and maybe some other obstacles to creativity you've seen in your clients and maybe some you've experienced yourself?
Well, I think most people run into these in the course of the work, either because writers face so many rejections and so many obstacles to getting their work out, and also because the process of writing, revising, etc., is full of potholes that people invariably stumble into, and where they go through droughts of inspiration or read over the material and it felt good when you were writing it, and then it sounds terrible when you read it over. And so there's multiple possibilities for doubting and feeling insecure about the projects.
It's almost an occupational hazard there.
It definitely
is.
And you can count on it.
You have several examples of very famous writers. In fact, I should read for the listeners. There's two fantastic quotes in the epilogue. One from Flannery O'Connor, one from Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
And the Flannery O'Connor one is, writing a novel is a terrible experience during which the hair often falls out and the teeth decay.
Don't you love that?
And Vonnegut's was he kind of one-upped her there.
Yeah.
His is, when I write, I feel like an armless, legless man with a crayon in his mouth. So, and that's two of our greatest American writers right there. With the same...
There you go. I mean, Flannery O'Connor's comment kind of takes the romance out of it, doesn't it?
Right.
Because why do we write? I mean, you know, when we know we're facing certain emotional upheaval along the
right.
way.
Right. Now, the book is called The Writer's Crucible, and the epilogue I haven't read yet to the book defines crucible. And the definition is a situation of severe trial or in which different elements interact, leading to the creation of something new. What is the writer's crucible?
Well, the writer's crucible is not a thing, really. It's a living process. I think of it as a living metaphor for the journey, the process of writing, in which writers undergo tremendous stress and uncertainty, but that is an integral and viable part of the process that transforms the work into something new.
So rather than see it as a negative, you see it as actually essential, something very constructive.
Exactly. That's why I love it as a metaphor, despite the quippings of Flannery O'Connor, because I think it's a very hopeful metaphor, because of this process leads to a transformation of the work into something new, into something that could not have been imagined really before the work began.
I was wondering, and I don't have this question down here, but it brings it to mind. Do you think there's a direct relationship between the amount of self-doubt and stress that a writer goes through and the actual quality of the finished work?
That's a good question. I think there probably is. These things coexist together. That there's something in the self-doubt is related to the passion and the intensity of the impulse to create.
There's something that you see in your head and you're trying to get that down on paper or on canvas or even in a musical work, And I think by definition, that's almost impossible. There's this ideal in our head, and we're never going to really hit that ideal.
Yeah, that's right. And it's inevitably there's feelings of inadequacy and falling short that accompany the process.
And I want to talk about that too, Philip. You mention in the book that a writer is actually working on two things at the same time. The work itself, the creative project, of course, and then what you call the self project. I was wondering how you define the self project and how you see that as an obstacle.
Well, the people are vulnerable beings, and these feelings of insecurity and self-doubt lead to compensatory actions and behaviors and strategies and maneuvers to try to overcome this feeling of insecurity or of lack. Try to overcome the feeling of not being good enough.
Is that like negative ones, like drinking, drugs, overeating? I don't know.
Well, it could be that. There are those that are based, that are intended to self-medicate, mm-hmm. like drinking, drugs, et cetera, overeating. And there are those that are what we traditionally think of as ego-driven, that are putting pressure on us to do the impossible, to be brilliant or to be, you know, extremely clever, rather than listening to the creative impulse within that and our own individual inspiration.
You mentioned envy and shame in the book as two of those negatives that can take us out of our own creativity. We want to, I don't know, I guess emulate someone else's success or...
Well, I really believe in the work I do and myself as a writer that shame is a critical and central emotion that people struggle with. It can be very debilitating, and it can lead to aversive behaviors to avoid the work or to...
Well, let's take that as an example. Say someone, a writer, is in the process of doing a book or a novel, and they're somewhat... hitting writer's block because of feelings of shame. Maybe that they feel they're not good enough. They're not living up to their inspirations, like
right.
Flannery O'Connor or Kurt Vonnegut.
Right.
How would you treat that?
Well, for one thing in the book, I recommend that therapy works, yoga works, that various things work to try to relax the system, and that shame, like a lot of feelings, needs to be faced. It needs to be, people try to distract from it or run from it. And there's an internal narrative that I'm not good enough that really needs to be confronted. It's amazing with people, very bright people, whose narrative of themselves is very simple and rigid. So I suggest to writers that they try to create a more complex narrative of themselves, and really challenge some of these voices that I say come from the shame brain or the anxious brain that keep on habitually telling us we're not enough.
What might be an example of something constructive in that to expand the complexity of the narrative, the self-narrative?
Well, one thing that's helpful, I think, and I do this with the book and some of the exercises, is to really try to... expand on your self-portrait to include, let's say, historical context. Let's say generational traumas that have been passed down that are not really of yourself, but have been absorbed in developmental years, and we sort of transmitted to children by well-intended folks, but who have not processed that. Those traumatic occasions.
So rather than blocking something, just kind of embrace it in a way.
Well, to try to embrace it, and really through, in the book there's a lot of psychological material to try to help people understand it. What creates these feelings? What makes us feel what we do and have these distorted ideas of who we are?
It's a wonderful book, extremely helpful, and I wish we had more time to talk about it, Philip, but how can listeners find out more about your work and maybe buy the book?
Well, the book is available at Broadway Books and perhaps soon Powell's. It's available on Amazon, and you can find out about me at Philip philip-kenny.com, my website.
Oh, great. Well, Philip, again, thanks very much for coming into KABU and
telling us all about
the Writer's Crucible.
Nice to be here.
We've been talking with Portland-based writer and psychotherapist Philip Kenny about his new book, The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. You can learn more about Philip and the book on his website, as he mentioned, philip-kenny, that's Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y.com. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
Have you heard?
KABU hosts beloved Community in Action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. right here at the radio station. On March 15th, we'll show the film Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars, a documentary film about the band composed entirely of refugees displaced to Guinea during the Civil War in Sierra Leone. Again, that's a screening of Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars in for the KABU Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, March 15th at 7 p.m. at KABU, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at KABU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs is a two-hour screening of Portland-related short documentaries produced by local independent filmmakers, including Mackenzie Blake, Outside the Frame, Sika Stanton, Donovan Smith, and more. The screening will be followed by an audience Q&A session. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. Minors allowed with parent or guardian. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Enough National School Walkout on Wednesday, March 14th, 10 a.m. at Roseway Heights School in Portland. Enough is calling for students, teachers, school administrators, parents, and allies to take part in the National School Walkout for 17 minutes.